monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 81, October 2024. Voices of the Civil Rights Movement. A conversation with Jacqueline Springfield. Hello, Paul Meyer here. It's been a very enjoyable month with projects. I have Zoom sessions every day with a huge variety of clients. Mostly actors needing dialect and accent work, but a lot of non-actors wanting to improve their English pronunciation. And a lot of people who speak for a living and want to improve their communication skills. If you have a spoken word need, check out my Zoom page. It's under the coaching tab on the menu bar at paulmeyer.com. But now some very sad news. One of my favourite clients of all time, Kris Kristofferson, died a few days ago, September 28th of this year, 2024, at his home in Maui. He was 88 years old. It had been my pleasure to coach Kris in the German accent he needed for his character Rudolf Meyer in the film Molokai. He was a complete gentleman. I'll miss you, Kris. It was great to know you. Opening with our quiz, guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
Ida was born December 7th. 1982. I had two doctors and six nurses. And the doctor, amazingly, took bets as whether she's a boy or a girl. And out of the eight professionals, the two doctors and the six nurses, seven said boy. And he said girl, because he knew, I'm sure he knew ahead of time.
So, what was your guess? It was Ideas Armenia 1. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Asia, then Armenia. Associate Editor Mark Ingram contributed it in 2007. Thanks again, Mark. Now this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
In that particular instance, he told me a lot about my friend, how he was doing, and that there were some hope that he may recover. Yeah, this was a car accident. And it was really, we were crossing our finger, and the last time, at one of those nights when I talked to my dad, he said that there was some hope that he may recover. Yeah, but next day, my dad called me and he said that he had died.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 81. You'll find lots of details about my guest and other relevant audio and video links. Not available on any other podcast channel. My guest this month is Jacqueline Springfield, making her second appearance on In a Manner of Speaking. She previously talked with us about heightened language and black playwrights. August 2021. Welcome back, Jacqueline, to In a Manner of Speaking.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Nice to have you back. Following our last podcast, hugely popular with our listeners, by the way, I invited you to prepare a review of the voices of the Black civil rights movement here in the United States, starting in the earliest days of sound recordings right up to the present. So thanks for accepting the challenge. I hope it didn't take a huge amount of your time.
It was a pleasure to do. So I'm really excited to get into it.
I love the 10 voices you'd chosen to document that journey. And we got a bonus voice and an 11th voice that we'll play right at the end. So number one, Booker T. Washington from back in 1895. Give us the context of this famous speech, please.
Yes. So this is the Atlanta Exposition speech from 1895. The style that we hear is very indicative of the public speaking style of the time. When Booker T. Washington gave this speech, he was talking to both Black and white audience members, and he was talking about the agricultural realities of the time, and he wanted to get white farmers to be more mindful about how they were treating the Black sharecroppers that they were working with. This was about 30 years after the end of slavery, so there was what we call the Negro problem, meaning that now that Black people were part of society, how were they going to live as one?
Right. So I'm going to play a little bit of that recording that you picked out, undoctored. And then I've got a slightly noise reduced version that will be a little clearer to understand. So here's a little of the recording, untreated.
Mr. President and gentlemen of the board of directors and citizens, 1/3 of the population of the South is of a Negro race. No enterprise, the material, civil, or moral welfare of this section can disregard this element of our population and reach the highest success.
So as you can hear, that's terribly difficult to understand completely. So let me play a slightly noise-reduced version of that.
Mr. President and gentlemen of the Board of Directors.
Mr. President and gentlemen of the Board of Directors.
And citizens.
And citizens.
1/3 of the population of the South is of the Negro race.
1/3 of the population of the South is of the Negro race.
No enterprise seeks the material, civil, or moral welfare of this section.
No enterprise seeking the material, civil, or moral welfare of this section.
Can disregard this element of our population and reach the highest success.
Can disregard this element of our population and reach the highest success.
I will convey to you, Mr. President and Directors, the sentiment of the masses of my race.
I must convey to you, Mr. President and Directors and Secretaries and masses of my race.
When I say that in no way have the value and manhood of the American Negro been more fittingly and generously recognized.
When I say that in no way have the value and manhood of the American Negro been more fittingly and generously recognized.
And by the managers of this magnificent exposition at every stage of its progress.
And by the managers of this magnificent exposition at every stage of its progress.
It is a recognition that will do more to cement the friendship of the two races.
It is a recognition that will do more to cement the friendship of the two races.
And any occurrence since the dawn of our freedom.
And any occurrence since the
dawn of our freedom. Not only this, but the opportunity here afforded will awaken among us a new era of industrial progress.
Not only this, but the opportunities here afforded will awaken among us a new era of industrial progress. Isn't that amazing? I mean, as an artifact from all that long time ago, it's amazing that we have that recording. Yeah, you can view the full recording of the podcast on the podcast page at paulmeyer.com. So what would you say about Mr. Washington's manner of speaking?
So even though he was born enslaved in Alabama, he was primarily self-taught until he went to Hampton Normal Agricultural Institute in Virginia. And that school was created to educate freedmen. So he received an education, and you can hear that in his speaking. The time period is such that he received elocution classes. And so you'll notice, if you're familiar with Edith Skinner's work or William Tilley's work, you'll notice a lot of the hallmarks of that kind of speech.
Yes.
A lot of the tapped R on American and every. You'll notice the elision of the last syllable, particularly when words end in the airy and the last syllable. So secretaries, linking of final consonant into vowels on the next word, so this element or not only. And you'll also notice a lot of pitch variety where there's the idea of sort of replicating what you hear in RP. In speech making, a lot of those same kind of hallmarks you would find people doing. And so you find him doing that in this speech.
The value that society placed on good speech, however you might define that back then, what a cultural shift has happened since then. Would you not agree?
Absolutely. And there's been a lot of talk about that and about the term good speech in particular.
Yes. It's an astonishing artifact. I'm so pleased that history has preserved that to us. Number two, William Edward Burghardt Dubois. When did he deliver this speech?
So this speech comes from 1960. So Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, they were only born 12 years apart, and they were, in a sense, political adversaries. And though they were contemporaries, these speeches were given about 65 years apart. So Du Bois was 92 years old when he gave this speech in 1960.
What then is the next step? It is for American Negroes in increasing numbers and more widely to insist upon the legal rights which are already theirs, and then to add to that increasingly a socialistic form of government, an insistence upon the welfare state which denies the further carrying out of industry for the profit of those corporations which monopolize wealth and power, the stopping of a government of wealth, for wealth and for wealth, and the returning of governmental power to the individual voter with all the freedom of action that can be preserved, along with an industry carefully organized for the good of the masses of people and not for the manufacture of millionaires.
I like masses, not for the masses. What would you say about this
gentleman? You hear completely different styles here because they are so far apart.
Yes.
One of the things you do hear that is similar is with Du Bois, you do hear a lot of pitch variety, but you don't hear those tapped R's. You don't hear that same kind of elision in the multisyllabic word endings. He was born in Massachusetts. He did not come to the South, unlike Washington, who was born and educated in the South. Du Bois only came to the South when he came to attend Fisk University. So he has a lot of really robust R sounds, and you hear that in theirs and government.
Yes, despite his Massachusetts origin, right?
Right. But the thing is, the part of Massachusetts that he lived in, particularly at the time that he grew up, had very rhotic R sounds.
Uh-huh.
You also hear a lot of very round O sounds, voter and Negro.
Yes, I love that sound. Oh, voter, yes.
Voter and Negro. You also hear sibilant S sounds, which I think might be a combination of his own personal speech, but also the recording itself, perhaps the microphone or the equipment of the time period.
Yeah, I put that sibilant S down to his age.
It could perhaps be dentures that he might have had as well. Yeah,
pipes and whistles in his sound, as Jaques says. Okay. So number three is Mamie Till Mobley, mother of lynching victim Emmett Till. Remind us of her story briefly, and that of her son, of course.
So Emmett Till was, at the time, a 14-year-old boy, grew up in Chicago. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, sent him to spend some time in the summer with his family in Mississippi, where she was from originally. And he was kidnapped from his grandfather's home, tortured and murdered, supposedly for whistling at a white woman. Mm-hmm. And Mamie Till Mobley made it her mission to talk about her son's murder, and his murder was essentially, and her speaking about it was essentially what started the civil rights movement in America.
Yeah. Watershed moment. My wife's grandmother is a Mobley. You pronounce her Mobley. So
yes, she pronounced it Mobley.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's listen to Mamie Till Mobley.
Something was spoken to me, and that something was, I am the ruler of heaven and earth. I see all things. I'm commissioning you to go into the vineyard and work. And what is right, I will pay. And don't forget that vengeance is mine. And a wonderful thing happened to me. It seemed like someone took a giant eraser, and my mind had become a chalkboard, and everything, all memories of Mr. Milam and Mr. Bryant were erased from my thoughts. I was able to go out into the vineyard and work, which I'd been commissioned to do, and that work turned out to be training boys and girls to do Dr. King's speeches. I can truthfully say that for 47 years, I have not wasted any time hating Milam and Bryant. They became inconsequential so far as I was concerned. It was as if they didn't even exist.
What a wonderful woman.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What do you find interesting about her manner of speaking?
So this was her last public appearance before she passed away, about a month after she spoke. She was 81 years old at the time. And she had been born in Mississippi, but she moved to Argo, Illinois, near Chicago, about a month after she'd been born. So she was raised in Chicago. And so you don't hear a lot of the South in her voice for that reason. And she was trained as a teacher. So you hear the crisp diction and the elocution that she has comes from her training. You notice when she speaks that she never uses any fillers. She always takes her time to use her breath to connect her thoughts. Mm. There's never an or a you know. She clearly aspirates her T's. She's very thorough in completing a thought. She literally crosses her T's and dots her I's, as any good teacher does. And she always was a very strong public speaker. The NAACP actually sent her on a tour after Emmett's death because she was such an effective public speaker. Mm. And I think one of the things that you hear in terms of her rhythm of speaking in this particular clip is that you can hear she's speaking about a subject that she has really lived with for a very long time. Yes. And that's part of the rhythm of the speech, is that she's sat with it and she has a familiarity with it that comes through the years. This was over 45 years after Emmett Till's death.
You think she had a script on this occasion?
I don't think she did, because she had been speaking about it for so long and speaking about it to so many different audiences in a particular way for so long. This particular speech that she gave was it had been passed around recently in connection with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so even though this was from 2001, it was passed around again, because when she gave it, it was to a group of mothers who had lost their sons to gun violence. Mm. And in many cases to police brutality as well. Mm. It was a subject that she knew well, because it was not just about her son, but it was a community that she was accustomed to speaking to. So it was off the cuff. Mm. It came from her soul, you know.
The thing that strikes me about all the clips you've chosen is the illusion, if they are using a script, that they've got it completely off the page, or you don't sense a script writer or a speech writer in the background of any of these clips. Somehow they're speaking so authentically, whether they're reading a prepared script or not. There's a depth of conviction and familiarity and a sense of justice and rectitude that it's hugely effective public speaking, isn't it?
It really is, because their objective is to persuade and to inspire. And even in cases where people do have a script, that's why these particular people have become leaders.
Yes.
You know, became leaders is because they had to move the masses.
That's
so
right.
Script or no, you really feel their conviction to their cause.
Exactly. Number four, Dr. Martin Luther King, speaking about violence versus nonviolence in an interview. Can you give us the context of this TV interview?
So this was an interview that Dr. King did on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. This was in 1966. We're accustomed to hearing Dr. King's speeches that he gives, but this is an interview where we get to hear some of those same mannerisms that he's most well known for, but in a different context.
There is an increasingly vocal minority who disagreed totally with your tactics, Dr. King.
There's no doubt about that. I will agree that there is a group in the Negro community advocating violence now. I happen to feel that this group represents a numerical minority. Surveys have revealed this. The vast majority of Negroes still feel that the best way to deal with the dilemma that we face in this country is through nonviolent resistance. And I don't think this vocal group will be able to make a real dent in the Negro community in terms of swaying 22 million Negroes to this particular point of view. And I contend that the cry of black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro.
Now, please remember that we're playing short excerpts from all these speeches and that you can find links to the much longer speeches in their entirety on the podcast page at palmyre.com.
So Dr. King grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. He was a Morehouse man, so he was educated in Atlanta. He was also educated in Boston University, and he received training from a very young age, from beginning with his own father, who was a minister. He was trained to be a Baptist minister from the time he was very young. So you hear his education in his voice. You hear the training that he received all of his life. He has a beautiful baritone voice. That's in large part why he is probably the most, not probably, he is the most well-known voice of the civil rights movement. People know him for that beautiful baritone. He has a really nice balance of chest resonance in his lower tones. Even in the interview, you can hear that. And then when he goes into his higher tones, there's a really beautiful mask resonance that he has.
Bell-like overtones, I'm hearing.
Just really resonant throughout the entirety of his pitch range.
So if it's not what you say, but how you say it, then he's a textbook case, isn't he?
He's the prime example of that. And that's why he had such an impact. One of the hallmarks of any minister, but particularly Black Southern Baptist ministers, you'll find will hold out vowels for emphasis. And this is one of the things I talked about in the previous podcasts on one of the hallmarks of the Black church is speaking into singing. So what you'll find is he holds out vowels in a manner where it becomes almost singing, and you'll hear him doing that.
He operates at the boundaries between speaking and singing, doesn't he? I love to think of that the most effective speaking has something of song in it, as we discussed before.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Fantastic. Number five, Fannie Lou Hamer. Where does she fit into the story?
So I really love this particular example because Fannie Lou Hamer often gets left out of the story. Many of the women of the civil rights movement do, but she was not as educated as many of the more well-known civil rights leaders are. I wanted to include her, but she was known as a powerful speaker and a powerful orator. This particular clip that we're about to listen to was her speaking to the Credentials Committee. This was her testimony of what happened to her when she went to register to vote.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roosevelt, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color.
Yeah, so her voice in the civil rights movement is distinctive, isn't it? But not so schooled.
Exactly. She was born in central Mississippi, so you hear this very layered Southern dialect. She was born into a sharecropping family, and her family, she was one of 20 children. Like many sharecropping families, she had to leave school at the age of 12 because her parents were getting older and she had to leave to help tend to the crops. So she wasn't able to finish her education, but she was brilliant. Before she left school, she was reciting poetry. Mm. She won spelling bees. She just wasn't able to continue her education the way many other people that we are listening to had been able to. She developed her reading and her interpretation skills through Bible study. So she still had an understanding of speech and how the written word and how the spoken word could have power and how it could impact people. But what you hear is the hallmarks of Southern speech. You hear very dark L. So when she says 26 miles, so the L is very, very dark till it almost disappears completely.
Can you imitate that?
26 miles.
Yeah.
26 miles. And then you'll notice the addition of S on the plural. So she says policemen's, patrolmen's. You'll hear the non-rhotic pronunciation, started and color. You'll hear the emphasis on the first syllable, police. Driving becomes driving. So a lot of the hallmarks of Southern speech from her central Mississippi upbringing, and then the combination of the limited amount of education that she had.
You can't help thinking that this culture is closer to oral traditions, to orality, right?
Absolutely. And I think that we tend to forget that the written word was not always how information was passed down. It wasn't always what was valued about who told the stories and who were the keepers of tradition.
Yes. It's amazing public speaking, all of the clips you've chosen. Fantastic. Number six, Malcolm X. Where do you locate Malcolm X in the narrative?
If we look at Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois as political adversaries and compare and contrast their vocal styles, we do the same, and many people even to this day still do the same with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. They were kind of considered opposite ends of the political spectrum. Whereas Martin Luther King, as he was talking about in the clip, was a proponent of nonviolence, Malcolm X's refrain was by any means necessary. He talks a little bit about that in this particular clip that we're about to listen to.
Let's listen to it now.
We are African, and we happen to be in America. We're not American. We are people who formerly were Africans who were kidnapped and brought to America. Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us. We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today. Because we weren't brought here to be made citizens today, now that we've become awakened to some degree and we begin to ask for those things which they say are supposedly for Americans, they look upon us with hostility and unfriendliness.
And when you read about Malcolm X's upbringing and his life experience, his political point of view is very understandable, isn't it?
Yes. Malcolm X's whole argument was that there had been such violence enacted upon Black people that violence was to be answered. I think there was a lot of misunderstanding around his stance. And his stance actually at the latter part of his life began to change. Both Malcolm X, who was born Malcolm Little, I just want to put that in there, but both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King started to change their philosophies and their ideologies a little bit so that they kind of started to meet in the middle toward each other at the end of their respective lives. If we were to compare their ideologies and think of them as opposite ends of the spectrum, their vocal styles are kind of opposite as well. He moved around a lot. He was born in Oklahoma, then he moved to Milwaukee, then he moved to Nebraska. His father died when he was young. His mother was from the West Indies, so he had some of those sounds when he was very young that I think influenced some of his speech rhythms. And then he, because his father passed away and his mother had some issues where she was unable to care for him consistently, he was in a lot of foster homes. So yes, he had a lot of influences in terms of what sounds he was hearing. It made for a tumultuous life. But in terms of the way he speaks, there's a lot of a staccato rhythm. So as opposed to Dr. King, where we talked about there was a lot of elongation and a lot of resonance and that speaking into singing, you get a lot of punching with volume, almost like a drum, that sort of staccato, that sort of aggression, that sort of defense that Malcolm X has matches his ideology, just like that sort of elongation matches the nonviolent stance of Dr. King.
That's a fabulous insight. His speech is as impeccable as his famous way of dressing. Yes.
Yes. Oh, he was a snazzy dresser. Most of these people were impeccable dressers.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Fortunately, I'm going to be able to put the entire video clip on the webpage associated with this podcast, so you'll be able to see as well as hear their speech. Number seven, Stokely Carmichael. You chose a 1969 speech he gave about Malcolm X and Black Power. What would you say about Stokely Carmichael?
This was a few years after Malcolm X's death. So Stokely Carmichael wanted to kind of carry the mantle forward. He represented the newer generation who wanted to move into what we call the Black Liberation Movement. And so now what you had was a much more direct speaking style than what you found in civil rights leaders up until now. So you see that what we have in this clip is a much, much more of a conversation, much more informal. It's not so much of a speech as more of a back and forth. And you'll see that in the dialect. You'll see that in the way that Stokely Carmichael connects with the audience.
How old is he at this point?
He was 23, maybe 24 at this time.
He looks very young.
Now we have two psychological battles that we're fighting against white folk. We won one. They told us that we should hate Malcolm X. We dumped that, thank God. Now the second battle that we're now fighting is whether or not we will have the right to use the terms to decide how our movement is going to go. They don't want us to use Black Power. I got news for them. Because what Black Power was supposed to do was to start bringing Black people together under a slogan that everyone understood. But what in fact is done is it's organized white people and their Negro allies.
Stokely Carmichael, and he later changed his name to Kwame Ture. He was actually born in Trinidad. So you hear some of the inflections because he has some of the West Indian speech patterns, even into his 20s. He moved to New York at age 11. You hear like that really incredibly down to earth delivery. It's much more of a conversation. You hear him waiting for the audience reaction. He even elicits a response. So where he says that they wanted us to hate Malcolm X. We dumped that, thank God. He wants the audience to respond. He uses humor. His whole down-to-earth delivery is actually very New York. So, you know, him growing up in New York from 11, you can hear that in the rhythm of his speech and the mode of communication he uses. He leans a lot into the usage of Black dialect. So, for instance, he says, the fight that we fighting against white folk. And he slips back and forth kind of between a West Indian cadence and sort of a New York rhythm. He was critical of Martin Luther King, who he saw as the old guard. And Martin Luther King had passed away at this point as well, but he was critical of Martin Luther King and some of the civil rights leaders from the years before. And you can hear the difference in their style. So Stokely Carmichael was representative of the new guard, and you can see the difference in their approach.
And his choice of wardrobe sort of suits that style too, doesn't
it? Yes, you can see that too, yes.
Open collared shirt.
And this was 1969, so you could see how the country was really shifting.
Yes.
In terms of speech, mannerism, dress, all of those things.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Number eight, Shirley Chisholm, first African-American congresswoman, first African-American to run for U.S. president. So we're going to listen to her in this interview on the campaign trail 52 years ago in 1972.
Also, another person who has New York roots, she was born in Brooklyn, but her parents were from the West Indies. She'll mention this in the clip, but she was a speech writer for other people who had run for president. So you'll hear a real facility with words, even in just this short clip.
I'm so interested in her referring to herself in the third person.
Yes.
Listen for that, folks.
Mrs. Chisholm, how do you account for the fact that no more blacks than have come to your cause in this primary process and now at the convention?
Well, I think you have to recognize, first of all, gentlemen, you have to really recognize that I'm doing something this country that's never really been done before. It's a question of inculcation, reorientation, and education. Never before in this country, ever since the inception of the Republic, have you had a woman seriously running for the presidency. I'm not talking about someone nominating someone at the convention as a mere gesture of symbolism and tokenism. I'm talking about someone that has been going out in the highways and byways for the past 7.5 months and saying to the American people that if indeed this is a multifaceted society, that Mrs. Chisholm also can be considered a person that can run for the presidency of this country. I was breaking a tradition in which only white males have only been the gentlemen in this country that have guided the ship of state. So you don't expect people, black, white, men, or women, to suddenly overcome a tradition that has been steeped ever since the inception of this republic.
An amazingly different speaker.
Absolutely. You have the New York and West Indian integration there. She was also on the debate team. So what you hear her doing, she uses a lot of repetition to prove her point. And she speaks very quickly. You know, oftentimes with a debate team, you have a certain amount of time to make your argument. It's almost like you can hear her making her argument before the clock runs out.
She's beating the clock for sure.
She uses a lot of lift of pitch for emphasis, which you can hear in a lot of West Indian dialects. So she says, "This is not what I'm doing, gentlemen." So she has this lift in the middle of sentences to make the point, and then she brings it down at the very end. And there's a lot of staccato rhythms in between those times where she lifts that pitch. So between her debate team experience, her experience as a speech writer, having a real facility with words, with rhetoric, she's the perfect speech giver.
She is. There was a couple of phrases where it was a little kettle bottle kind of ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. It wasn't a little city, but little city, that kind of precision. Yes, again.
Yes, lots of precision, yes.
Number 9, coming ever closer to our own time, Jesse Jackson, a protege of Martin Luther King. Yes. What's his place in the history of the movement, as far as you're concerned?
Jesse Jackson, starting in the 1970s, early 80s, you started to have a more optimistic message being given by civil rights leaders. You also started to have a lot of, and this is really people kind of following after King, that people were looking for a new Martin Luther King. And because he had been a protege of King, that was one of the reasons a lot of people were looking to Jackson to kind of be a leader. You hear a lot of the Baptist preacher rhythms in his delivery. You also hear a lot of biblical stories and parables being used. So you hear him using that. And you hear like an overall message of overcoming, of triumph, and of optimism.
I close with another story. There's a little shepherd boy named David. Everybody in town was scared of Goliath. Philadelphia, your time has come. Don't stop at the mayor's office. Go on higher. Because you must never forget that about the time we began to take over cities, Nixon shifted the power to the suburbs. And now Reagan shifted it to the states. So you got mayors with more and more responsibility and less power. We got more and more folk and fewer services. We cannot stop. We got to rise on higher. Little David. Little David. Little David. Took off his unnecessary garments. Little David. Did didn't want to get weighted down with a lot of foolishness. Little David took what God gave him, a slingshot and a God biscuit, a rock.
An amazing speaker. I wish I had been there to experience that live, don't you?
Absolutely.
Such a distinctive style and distinctive accent.
So Jesse Jackson was born in Greenville, South Carolina, where I had the pleasure of spending a few weeks just recently. And as we said, he was a protege of MLK. So you can hear, you know, those Southern Baptist preacher rhythms. And then with the story of David and Goliath using a parable to teach a lesson. Because of him being from South Carolina, you hear that non-rhotic pronunciation. So shepherd becomes shepherd, hiya, instead of boy becomes by. So a lot of the R sounds become non-rhotic. Dark L sounds, Philadelphia becomes Philadelphia. You hear the long I sounds start to shift. So you hear time and rise. And the story itself, as I was saying before, is one of optimism and triumph and overcoming, hallmark of the time period.
Such a multiplicity of styles in the clips you've chosen. It's a real symphony, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Number 10 in this amazing parade of voices, the Reverend Al Sharpton, speaking in the clip you chose at the funeral of Rosa Parks. This was November 2nd, 2005. Talk about them both briefly before I play the clip.
This is kind of a continuation of the idea of hope and optimism. Al Sharpton took a little bit more assertive stance, being from Brooklyn, still leans into a lot of the same kind of mannerisms, leans into African-American vernacular English, really takes the audience to church in terms of the inflections that he uses.
The one we got to battle is James Crow Jr. Esquire. He's a little more educated. He's a little slicker. He's a little more polished. But the results are the same. He doesn't put you in the back of the bus. He just puts referendums on the ballot to end affirmative action when you can't go to school. He doesn't call you a racial name. He just marginalizes your existence. He doesn't tell you that he's set against you. He sets up institutional racism, where you have a nation respond looking for weapons in Iraq that are not there, but can't see a hurricane in Louisiana that is there.
So authentic. I can't imagine anyone but him writing this powerful oration. Can't imagine a speechwriter in the background, can you?
Absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing is, it wouldn't be anyone's funeral except for someone like Rosa Parks, where you would say something like this, because most funerals would have a somber tone, but he's still fighting the good fight because of who Rosa Parks was.
Not at all inappropriate for her funeral, right? Is it?
Exactly, right, because her life was such an inspiration. Still, even now, a speech needs to match that occasion, that it still needs to inspire, so that even her message continues on, even after she's gone. Al Sharpton was the youth director for Shirley Chisholm's campaign. What you find him doing is leaning into African-American vernacular English here. So doesn't comes out as Dutton, and can't becomes can't. And you hear that elongation of vowels that Black preachers will do. And, you know, as I was saying before, even though he's from New York, he's from Brownsville, Brooklyn, you still get those elongation of vowels that sound very Southern. Because so much of what you find happening is because King, who was from the South, sort of put the stamp on what Black civil rights leaders sounded like, then you had people replicating that, or at least attempting to.
Amazing. Yes. What one powerful forebear can have, what effect he can have on subsequent generations. Yeah. Yeah. And finally, our bonus voice, as I'm referring to it as, pointing us towards the future This is going to be the closing minute of his farewell speech as he left office after 8 years as the first African-American president of the United States. We've traveled from 1895 to 2017, from Booker T. Washington to Barack Obama, just over 100 years.
I chose this for the last sample because we started out with Booker T. Washington talking about the hope that Black people would be able to have a small part in being able to make a place for themselves after slavery, and Barack Obama being the fulfillment of so many dreams, even though we have so far to go. I thought it was fitting to have him be the last sample, that there was a sense of it being full circle.
Exactly.
My fellow Americans, it has been the honor of my life to serve you. I won't stop. In fact, I will be right there with you as a citizen for all my remaining days. But for now, whether you are young or whether you're young at heart, I do have one final ask of you as your president. The same thing I asked when you took a chance on me 8 years ago. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours. I am asking you to hold fast to that faith written into our founding documents, that idea whispered by slaves and abolitionists, that spirit sung by immigrants and homesteaders and those who marched for justice, that creed reaffirmed by those who planted flags from foreign battlefields to the surface of the moon, a creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can. Thank you. God bless you. May God continue to bless the United States of America. Thank you.
I'm so grateful for what you've done here, Jacqueline. I've heard many of these speeches before. Some were new to me, but hearing them back to back was quite an experience. The cumulative power of these 11 speakers, overwhelming, isn't it?
It is overwhelming. I was grateful to be able to have the chance to do it. It meant a lot for me to take the time to listen to these voices. It was an inspiration for me to be able to dwell on the messages that all these speakers had.
It's a testament to the enduring power of the spoken word to affect change, isn't it? Don't you think? It's just a textbook of how to do that.
Yes.
With the spoken word. And as spoken word practitioners, you and I, going to be very, very proud of these people, and we'll learn from them. Did you learn anything new or change your point of view as you put together this fine piece of oral history?
I learned a lot of specifics about the people that I chose to share the clips of. There were a lot more people that I would, if we had, you know, hours, that I would have shared clips of, but there were details, little details that I didn't know. For instance, Fannie Lou Hamer, though I knew some things about her, there were details that I didn't know. I learned a little bit more about everyone, and it only deepened my respect for all of them. And it helped me to see more of a through line of the civil rights leaders in this country. And it just filled me with pride, particularly in an election year.
Thanks for talking to me today, Jacqueline.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate it. Always a pleasure.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guest, Jacqueline Springfield, an outstanding associate editor of IDEA, scholar, professor, actor, and director. And she's also a generous financial contributor to IDEA. Thank you so much for all you do, Jacqueline. For fuller information about her, go to paulmeyer.com. Choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar and click episode number 81. You'll find there all 11 video clips embedded on that page in their entirety, all taken from YouTube and used under the copyright doctrine of fair use. Details on the webpage. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. Next month, my guest is Karen Burgos, who scored such a big hit on episode number 70, How American English Got Its Start. This time, Karen and I will discuss how pop singers, throughout the English-speaking world nearly always use American English pronunciation when they sing. Why is that? Find out next time on In a Manner of Speaking.